Due to the graphic nature of this killer's crimes, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes dramatizations and discussions of murder and assault that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for children under 13. Now, enjoy the show. March 18th, 1919, and the city of New Orleans sounds like this. Because 5 days earlier, a murderer threatened to kill them all.
I am very fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether regions that every person shall be spared in whose home a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have just mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well, then so much the better for you people. One thing is certain, and that is that some of your people who do not jazz it on Tuesday night, if there be any, will get the axe.
Everyone jazzed it. And you know what?
The axe man didn't murder a soul.
Hi, I'm Greg Polson, and welcome to Serial Killers, a new podcast diving into the minds and motives of some of the most infamous and notorious serial killers. This week, we continue our look into the Axeman of New Orleans, a jazz-loving, chop-happy murderer who terrorized the city from 1917 to 1918. If you want to listen to any previous episodes of Serial Killers, you can find them all in your favorite podcast directory. Don't forget to subscribe. You can also listen on our website, parcast.com. Spelled parcast.com. A new episode comes out every Monday. Visit our Facebook page, Parcast, to join the conversation.
Last time, we left off on March 13th, 1919.
That's right. And before we continue, I'd like to welcome back Vanessa. She's here to provide insight into the psychology of serial killers. Remember, she's not a psychologist or psychiatrist herself, but she's done a ton of research on the subject.
Thanks, Greg. So if you'll recall, by March 13th, the Axeman had attacked 9 people. He usually chiseled out a panel from their back door in the dead of night, snuck into their bedroom, and butchered them with an axe or some other household object as they lay asleep. By this point, he had killed 4.
Police arrested multiple suspects, releasing all of them. They found a possible connection between these murders and another series of killings at the beginning of the decade, but it led nowhere. They were baffled.
The Axeman had worked the people of New Orleans into hysteria.
Vanessa, what happens in situations like this when a panic spreads through a population?
Well, unfortunately, one thing we see frequently is people taking advantage of the opportunity.
Like price gougers after a natural disaster?
Exactly. Take this 1918 ad placed in the Times-Picayune by the grocery chain Piggly Wiggly. Written as a joke letter to the superintendent of police, Frank T. Mooney, it appeared 5 months before the Axeman's famous dispatch.
Attention, Mr. Mooney, and all citizens of New Orleans. The Axeman will appear in this city on Saturday, August 24th. He will ruthlessly use the Piggly Wiggly axe in cutting the heads off all the high-priced groceries. His weapon is wonderful and his system is unique. Don't miss seeing him.
Yikes, that's pretty...
dark? Yeah, probably not advertising's proudest moment.
Especially considering so many of the Axeman's victims were local Italian grocers. As we established previously, the Crescent City has a macabre sense of humor. This ad is an example of a poor attempt to cope with the panic through humor. What you'll also find in these scenarios are people, understandably, having a heightened sense of anxiety.
Dozens of concerned citizens alerted police, claiming they found axes near their homes.
Well, put yourself in their shoes. A serial killer is going around sneaking into your neighbor's homes and butchering them. Wouldn't you be on edge? You might suspect that any sound you hear is that killer. During a public murder spree like this, everyone probably feels a sense of helplessness, and they're doing what they can to maintain control during a frightening time. So if a killer threatens to bomb a bus,
as the Zodiac did,
you may avoid public transit. Or if someone is randomly sniping people at gas stations,
as Lee Boyd Malvo and John Allen Muhammad did during the Beltway sniper attacks,
you'd hide your gas station pumps with tarps to assure your customers that they're safe. When you're threatened, even if it's not a direct threat, we find ways to avoid or protect ourselves from it. So if an axe murderer tells you to play jazz...
you play jazz.
Superintendent Mooney tried to reassure the people of New Orleans.
Take this for the gospel. We're going to get him yet. I'm doing everything in human power to run down this murderous maniac. We're going to get him.
He consulted local criminology experts, police from other cities, even the famous Pinkerton Detective Agency. They caught no one.
Which isn't to say police didn't have any suspects.
In fact, they had almost as many suspects as victims.
Last time we spoke about Andrew Maggio, the brother and brother-in-law of the first victims, Joseph and Catherine Maggio.
Andrew discovered his nearly dead brother and sister-in-law in their bedroom, slashed with Andrew's straight razor, and then hacked with an axe.
Police eventually released Andrew. Next up, Louis Obicon.
When the axemen attacked Louis Bessemer and Harriet Lowe in the back of Louis's grocery store, Harriet claimed,
"It was, mulatto."
Police apprehended a recent employee of Bessemer's, Louis Obicon.
Based on no evidence. Unfortunately, police made this error on multiple occasions.
Superintendent Mooney suspected another black man, Charles Anderson, who twice served time for robbery. Though not much is known about why Mooney suspected that. What happens in the mind of police when they arrest the wrong person?
First, let's remember that police are people too, and like you or me, they can make mistakes. The same as everyone in New Orleans at the time, they were scared, and they were desperate to put the public at ease and catch the killer. They sought control. Perhaps that led to hasty judgments on their part. What we see in situations like this is confirmation bias, where we tend to believe evidence that confirms what we already believe, rather than allowing new evidence to discredit that belief.
So, if Mooney was convinced the killer was a black man, he'd be quick to suspect Anderson, or arrest Obicon, even without evidence, simply based on the color of their skin. Similarly, police picked up a man named James Gleason after the attack on Mrs. Schneider, because like Anderson, he had a history of robbery. Detectives also thought maybe the killer knew the victims, arresting at different times family and an old employee. And twice, the police held neighbors of the victims. On August 20th, 1919, Frank Janusa answered his door to find his friend and neighbor Steve Boca covered in blood at the front step. Janusa held Boca inside where he collapsed. Although Janusa treated Boca's wounds and sought help, police arrested Janusa. It didn't take long before they realized the error of their ways, but they also arrested Frank and Irlando Giordano, who stood trial for murder in the case of the Cortamelia family.
Keep them in mind, because they weren't the only suspects who had a day in court. It's easy for detectives and prosecutors to focus on the wrong suspects because they're targeting a solution that they feel is right in front of their eyes. When police focus on that, they can be disincentivized from looking for alternate suspects. So when they think they have their killer, it's easy for police and prosecutors to develop tunnel vision.
Well, that sounds like what happened with Louis Bessemer. Bessemer was accused by his paramour and fellow victim Harriet Lowe of having attacked her. And then police found letters in Yiddish, Russian, and German in Bessemer's apartment. This was 1918, and the United States had been involved in World War I for over a year. Detectives believed that Bessemer may have been operating within our own borders as a spy. Bessemer was held for being a spy. And again, there was no real evidence. He claimed the letters were correspondence relating to imports. A little later, Lowe had surgery to treat her axe wounds, but complications arose, and as she lay dying...
It was Louis. Louis tried to do me in.
Oh. Police arrested Bessemer the very same day Mrs. Schneider was attacked. While he was being held, the axemen killed even more people. Bessemer still went to trial for murder. A jury found him innocent after just 10 minutes of deliberation. Looking at Lowe's accusations, she had also fingered, quote, a mulatto right after the attack, and her two claims against Bessemer happened when she was impaired. How reliable was her version of the events?
Not very. And there are also some accounts that claim Bessemer and Lowe had a drug history, so their impairment may have extended beyond just injuries sustained in the attack.
Well, how reliable is eyewitness testimony, even when you haven't just been hit in the head by an axe?
Well, at the time, police would have thought very reliable. But in recent years, research has shown eyewitnesses to be fallible. Our memories don't work like DVRs. We don't instantly replay events in our head like a complete episode of Two Broke Girls that we recorded. Instead, our brain stitches together the different parts of a memory each time we try to bring it up. It's easy for the separate pieces to get corrupted.
So false memories can be planted?
Sure. And this might not be deliberate. Through questioning and phrasing, an investigator questioning a witness may alter his or her recollection of an event. An improper identification is more likely when the witness is under extreme stress, at the crime scene or during the identification stage.
Both would be the case with Lowe.
And if weapons were present at the crime scene, that can contribute to the witness's stress.
Also happened here. The axe used to attack Lowe and Bessemer was found in the apartment.
If the attacker wore a disguise or covered up anything distinctive about them, that would obviously affect the specificity of a witness's memory.
While we don't have many good physical descriptions of the Axeman, the nieces of Joseph Romano did describe him as wearing a dark suit and slouched hat. So maybe Lowe wouldn't even have been able to see his face or any other distinguishing characteristics.
So in hindsight, Lowe's testimony could hardly be considered reliable. Maybe police at the time didn't know about all these complications with eyewitness testimony. Even if they did, they were under their own psychological stress to try to find the killer as quickly as possible.
Like my mechanic always says, you can do it fast or you can do it right. Unfortunately, things weren't so simple for the last two suspects, Frank and Irlando Giordano, who lived across the street from Rosie Charles and Mary Cortimiglia. You may recall the Cortimiglias from our last episode, perhaps the most tragic of the X-Men cases. The X-Men found the family sleeping in bed on March 10, 1919. Mary, only a baby, slept in her mother's arms. Rosie and Charles survived. Mary did not.
Help! Help us!
Screams woke the Giordanos, who rushed across the street to aid Charles and Rosie. So how do they end up being convicted of being the Axeman? Rosie Cortimiglia blamed them. Even though Charles denied the allegation and recalled only one attacker, police arrested Irlando and Frank. How likely was it they were responsible?
Not very. Irlando was 69 years old. Frank stood over 6 feet tall and 200 pounds. It would have been difficult for him to fit through the panel chiseled out of the Cortimiglia's back door. It is worth noting, however, that several Axeman survivors described their attacker as a large man.
And wouldn't you have to be a pretty big person to do the kind of damage the Axeman did?
Yes, so perhaps we can't fault the police here, and you certainly can understand the jury's reasoning. On the stand, Rosie Cortimiglia retold the events of that night with great detail.
Frank held me there while he went to get the axe.
What did he do next?
Frank got 3 licks on Mary.
And then you?
He hit me twice. I could do nothing. They were too big. He was strong. They'd already knocked down Charles, and Mary was... she was...
It's too painful to continue. Do you have any idea why they wanted to hurt you?
We'd gotten an argument with them.
About what?
They'd rented the building before us, and they wanted it back.
The court sentenced Frank, who was only 18, to hang. Irlando received a life sentence.
But they were eventually released. A year later, Rosie burst into the Times-Picayune office.
I lied. God has punished me. I've lost everything. My baby's dead. My husband's left me. I've had smallpox. St. Joseph visited me and told me to recant. Recant, he said, recant.
Is this another example of an eyewitness account gone way, way wrong?
Nope. And this is why this case is interesting. It presents an entirely different reason police and prosecutors may try the wrong suspect. That detailed account she told in court, all fake.
Fake? Why would anyone do that?
She confessed to making it up out of jealousy. She wanted to eliminate business competition.
We'll return to our story in just a moment.
And now, back to serial killers.
That's a half dozen people arrested for the Axeman's crimes. Do any of these suspects match the profile for the Axeman that we established in the last episode?
Based on what we know so far, the Axeman may have been a loner who knew his victims. He picked specific homes to break into, used weapons found in those homes, and killed in a rage, and he may have had a troubled childhood. Unfortunately, we don't know a lot of details about most of these suspects, so it's difficult to say. In the cases of Gleason and Anderson,
the two ex-cons with histories of robberies,
the Axeman notably did not steal from his victims. Theft and brutal axe murders with no overlap, those are two different kind of criminals.
What about the idea that the Axeman may have known his victims?
If Louis Bessemer, Louis Ubicon, Andrew Maggio, or the Giordanos were the Axeman, that certainly would be a possibility.
But it definitely wasn't the Giordanos.
Definitely not. As for Bessemer, there may be reasons why Bessemer could have attacked Lo in a rage, say, if she threatened to tell his wife about their affair, or if she discovered he really was a spy. That's perhaps why police found him to be a credible lead.
But how did they explain him attacking himself with an axe?
They didn't, which is probably why the jury acquitted him so quickly.
What about Ubicon?
Again, someone who could have had a reason to attack Bessemer. Perhaps if Ubicon left the grocery store under bad circumstances. But like with Bessemer and Maggio, there was a complete lack of evidence actually implicating them in the Axeman murders. And while they all knew one victim, none of them knew all the victims.
There would be two other suspects in the Axeman killings.
But neither were captured in New Orleans, and neither would come to light until years after the Axeman stopped killing. So let's return to them shortly.
First, the Axeman's famous letter. In March of 1919, newspapers received a letter addressed from hell. They published this letter in its entirety on March 13th.
Esteemed mortal, they have never caught me and they never will. They have never seen me, for I am invisible, even as the ether that surrounds your earth. I am not a human being, but a spirit and a demon from the hottest hell. I am what you Orleanians and your foolish police call the Axeman. When I see fit, I shall come and claim other victims. I alone know whom they shall be. I shall leave no clue except my bloody axe, besmeared with blood and brains of he whom I have sent below to keep me company. If you wish, you may tell the police to be careful not to rile me. Of course, I am a reasonable spirit. I take no offense at the way they have conducted their investigations in the past. In fact, they have been so utterly stupid to not only amuse me, but His Satanic Majesty, Francis Joseph, etc. But tell them to beware. Let them not try to discover what I am, for it were better that they were never born than to incur the wrath of the Axeman. I don't think there is any need of such a warning, for I feel sure the police will always dodge me, as they have in the past. They are wise and know how to keep away from all harm. Undoubtedly, you Orleanians think of me as a most horrible murderer, which I am, but I could be much worse if I wanted to. If I wished, I could pay a visit to your city every night. At will, I could slay thousands of your best citizens, for I am in close relationship with the Angel of Death. Now, to be exact, at 12:15, earthly time, on next Tuesday night, I am going to pass over New Orleans. In my infinite mercy, I am going to make a little proposition to you people. Here it is. I am very fond of jazz music, and I swear by all the devils in the nether region that every person shall be spared in whose home a jazz band is in full swing at the time I have just mentioned. If everyone has a jazz band going, well then, so much the better for you people. One thing is certain, and that is that some of your people who do not jazz it on Tuesday night, if there be any, will get the axe. Well, as I am cold and crave the warmth of my native Tartarus, and it is about time I leave your earthly home, I will cease my discourse. Hoping that thou wilt publish this, that it may go well with thee, I have been, am, and will be the worst spirit that ever existed either in fact or realm of fancy.
And he signed it?
The Axeman.
What does this letter tell us about the Axeman?
First, there's no way to discuss the letter without addressing the possibility that the Axeman himself did not send it. Maybe it was just a prank. Someone with the same sense of humor as whoever wrote the copy for that Piggly Wiggly ad.
But wouldn't that run the risk of inciting panic, though?
Of course. But in a way, that's what a prankster wants and for some reason finds funny.
Mm-hmm. Like the kids who wear the fake shark fins to scare people in Jaws?
Exactly. It's childish and dangerous. They also just may want attention. Take, for example, Eric Wheel, who called into a TV station pretending to be the Zodiac Killer at the height of his spree. He sought the few minutes of infamy that came from impersonating the Zodiac.
There are easier ways to get a rush than waiting for a madman or a woman to start murdering people so you can pretend to be them for a short time.
One would hope. Similarly, even if the Axeman himself did send the letter, we have no idea if any of the letter's outlandish statements are true. The mentions of Francis Joseph, the recently deceased Austro-Hungarian ruler, or his Satanic Majesty, or Tartarus, or the Angel of Death, all of that may have been an effort to confuse the police.
Even the Jazz?
Even the Jazz. In 1969, when Manson family members murdered Gary Hinman, they drew a panther paw on the wall of Hinman's home.
Why a paw?
It was a symbol of the Black Panthers, and Manson hoped he could trick police into thinking they were behind his family's murders. So, like Manson and the family, the Axeman could have been trying to mislead New Orleans investigators into suspecting someone else entirely. Or he hoped to flood them with red herrings.
So, can we dismiss the letter outright?
We cannot, because there's also nothing conclusive to suggest he didn't send it. And of course, since we don't have a definitive answer on who the Axeman is, we can't be certain about what a lot of this letter means, but for our purposes, let's break this letter down, compare elements to other killers, and see how the letter confirms or debunks anything we already think we know about him. And to start, we need to consider the kind of killer that writes to police or the public twice.
Twice? The Axeman sent two letters?
Sort of. Remember our first victims, the Maggios?
The husband and wife killed in their home with a razor and axe, yeah.
Right, and remember what was discovered on the sidewalk near their home?
The writing in the chalk.
Mrs. Joseph Maggio will sit up tonight, just like Mrs. Tony.
This was possibly in reference to the wife of Tony Sciambra, Johanna, and their unresolved murders from 1910.
Though, as we covered last week, this Mr. and Mrs. Tony were shot to death, making the Axeman link questionable.
So why does the killer try to communicate with the police or public like this?
Narcissism.
Is it that simple?
Yeah, pretty much. When a killer writes letters, they do it out of a desire to feel important. They want other people to know about their deeds without giving themselves up. Often they view themselves as insignificant individuals, and they're trying to inflate themselves. Let's look for a moment at Dennis Rader.
The BTK killer? Rader murdered four members of a family in Wichita, Kansas in 1974. He called a local newspaper and directed them toward a mechanical engineering book in the Wichita Public Library. Inside, he'd hidden the first of a handful of letters that he would send to police and media over the next three decades. In that first correspondence, he wrote, quote, "I write this letter to you for the sake of the taxpayer as well as your time. Those three dudes you have in custody are just talking to get publicity for the Otero murders. They know nothing at all. I did it by myself and no one's help. There's been no talk either. Let's put it straight." Unquote.
Yeah, killing alone wasn't enough for him, and he sought the notoriety that came with it. With the sidewalk message outside the Maggio home, the Axeman may have been trying to elevate the status of his deeds by connecting them to previous murders, whether or not he actually committed them.
Why not just confess to the murders then?
Where's the fun in that? Consider this part from the Axeman letter.
"If you wish, you may tell the police to be careful not to rile me. Of course, I am a reasonable spirit. I take no offense at the way they have conducted their investigations in the past."
And jumping ahead a little.
"But tell them to beware. Let them not try to discover what I am. For it were better that they were never born than to incur the wrath of the Axeman. I don't think there is any need of such a warning, for I feel sure the police will always dodge me as they have in the past. They are wise and know how to keep away from all harm."
These passages are about power. He's taunting the police, even threatening them. If he surrendered or identified himself, he would have lost all that power. And if he can keep this game up, his power can grow. Take, for example, the man who was perhaps one of the most famous letter writers in history.
This is the Zodiac speaking.
Our story will continue in a moment after the break. And now, back to our story.
This is the Zodiac speaking.
As the Zodiac's body count rose, he wrote more letters to newspapers and called into TV stations. In one letter, he threatened to shoot schoolchildren. He kept the entire city of San Francisco in the grips of terror for months.
Also, consider this letter from 20 years earlier.
From hell. Mr. Lusk. Sir, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman. Preserved it for you. The other piece I fried and ate. Oh, it was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out. If only you wait a little while longer. Signed, catch me when you can, Mr. Lusk.
That's Jack the Ripper.
Jack the Ripper sent the infamous From Hell letter to the head of a volunteer police unit in London. Like the Axeman, Jack the Ripper was never apprehended and claimed to have sent letters from the underworld. And in those letters, he taunted and threatened police.
So the Axeman wasn't even original.
Very little other details cross over with Jack the Ripper. But maybe the Axeman simply found inspiration in the From Hell letter and mimicked its style to achieve maximum effect.
So how often do serial killers actually believe they really are from hell, or that they have a connection with the devil or the angel of death, like the Axeman?
Have you ever heard someone say, "The devil made me do it"?
Sure.
Well, in 1981, Arne Cheyenne Johnson stabbed and murdered his landlord. His lawyers claimed he wasn't guilty because at the time of the attack, Johnson was possessed by a demon.
An unusual defense?
The first of its kind in the United States. It didn't work. Often killers who claim demonic possession, or in the case of the Axeman, demonic association, are schizophrenic. Let's look at David Berkowitz.
The son of Sam.
He also left a letter for the police near the bodies of two victims.
I am the monster, Beelzebub, the chubby behemoth. I love to hunt, prowling the streets looking for fair game, tasty meat.
And in another letter that Berkowitz sent to a reporter,
I am still here, like a spirit roaming the night, thirsty, hungry, seldom stopping to rest, anxious to please Sam. I love my work. Now the void has been filled.
Sam wasn't actually his father.
Sam was his neighbor. Berkowitz claimed to receive orders from a demon that took the form of Sam's dog, Harvey. Berkowitz hoped that in carrying out these orders, Satan would help him overcome his emotional pain and loneliness.
So it's not outside the realm of possibility that the Axeman really believed,
I am in a close relationship with the angel of death.
It's certainly possible. Dennis Rader also felt,
I just know it's a dark side of me. It kind of controls me. I personally think it's and I know it's not very Christian, but I actually think it's a demon that's within me. At some point in time, it entered me when I was very young.
How does this relate to the fact that the Axeman probably killed in a rage, as we established in the last episode?
If the Axeman was schizophrenic, perhaps he didn't understand his own psychological disorder and believed it to be some kind of supernatural connection.
Like the son of Sam.
Yeah. The Axeman doesn't say enough in his letter to determine if he felt like he, too, received orders from a demon or the devil, or if killing would bring him some kind of relief promised by the devil. But like the Axeman, Berkowitz was a disorganized killer. He tended to favor women sitting in parked cars at night.
Similar to how the Axeman chose unsuspecting couples sleeping in bed.
Rader, on the other hand, was more methodical. He often stalked his victims and subjected many of them to fetishistic, sexualized torture.
Some criminologists theorize that the Axeman himself was sexually sadistic.
That theory is built on the idea that the Axeman attacked his victims in bedrooms and killed more women than men. In reality, half his victims were men, and only half of the people he targeted actually died. Plus, he exhibited no sexual assault, fetishistic behavior, and no post-mortem acts of mutilation or desecration. None of the hallmarks of erotophonophilia, or lust murder, are present in the Axeman spree.
And what about the jazz?
He sounds like a fan.
Could he have been killing because of some kind of obsession with jazz?
That's always been a popular theory, and certainly there have been serial killers who were obsessed with music. Charles Manson was a failed musician and thought the Beatles were sending him secret coded messages through their music.
Which is why his family wrote Helter Skelter on walls in blood.
The jazz theory recently got primetime exposure when Danny Houston played a smooth saxophone-playing version of the Axeman on the third season of American Horror Story. But in reality, it's hard to confirm. There's no evidence of any other connection to jazz in any of the other Axeman killings. And in reality, the Axeman's jazz link is defined by a lack of murder. It did, however, give the Axeman control. A commonality found in many murderers is a desire for control and power. They feel they lack it, and they're able to take control of their own lives by momentarily dominating someone else's.
Reminds me of my cat.
More than anything, his threat to find anyone not playing jazz was just another way for him to feel in control. Imagine how powerful you would feel if you made an entire city do your bidding with one paragraph of one letter.
Or maybe a jazz musician stood to gain a quick buck, so he wrote a letter to the newspaper with the hopes that he and all his friends would book a gig that night. Can we glean anything from the letter's style?
Well, the letter is fairly well written, so it's possible he was educated. Though most serial killers are unlikely to seek post-secondary education, others, like Ted Kaczynski, Marcel Petiot, and H.H. Holmes, were doctors. Plus, the Axeman was apparently smart enough to evade capture for all that time.
What about anything in the Axeman's handwriting?
Unfortunately, we don't have the original text of the letter, but the note on the sidewalk outside of the Maggio's home was described as being done in childlike handwriting. Graphology, the study of handwriting, isn't always considered the most reliable insight into a killer's personality. Although those who believe in it would say that ugly handwriting indicates emotional volatility, it can also suggest low self-esteem or insecurity.
Well, that tracks with the notion that the Axeman wrote his letter out of a need to feel important.
That need is often at the root of a killer's motives.
The Axeman came for his final victim on October 27, 1919. That night, Esther Pepitone heard a struggle in the room of her husband, Mike. When she went to find him, he was already dead, and blood was splattered all over the room. Most reports say he was killed with an axe. Some claim it was with a pipe. After that, the Axeman disappeared.
Maybe he got bored with murder, or he succumbed to the flu outbreak. He could have been picked up for an unrelated crime and nobody made the connection. Or he moved, leaving New Orleans and his beloved jazz music behind.
In the years after the Axeman spree, two suspects have risen to prominence, potentially bringing the Axeman story to an end in a pair of unlikely places, Tacoma, Washington, or Los Angeles, California. On October 30th, 1947, police apprehended Jake Bird after he killed two women during a home robbery. Can you guess what his weapon of choice was?
An axe?
An axe. Born in Louisiana, Bird left home at 19. He worked for the railroads, traveling from town to town, killing lots of women along the way. Is there any chance this was the mulatto axe murderer from our last episode, who also murdered along a train line? Or even the Axeman of New Orleans? Bird admitted to as many as 46 murders in 11 states. However, none of his murders occurred in Louisiana or Texas, where the mulatto axe murderer also frequented. So Vanessa, is it possible he left a few out?
I don't think so. Bird also made a spectacle of himself. He proudly claimed these 46 victims. During his trial, when he was allowed to make a statement to the court, he said,
"I'm putting the Jake Bird hex on all of you who had anything to do with my being punished. Mark my words, you will die before I do," unquote. And true to his word, six men associated with his arrest and trial passed before Bird was hanged for his crimes.
Ooh, So in Bird, you have a killer who apparently made no effort to hide any of his crimes, maybe even exaggerating his body counts and claiming murders he himself did not commit. And in The Axeman of New Orleans, a killer who sought attention and notoriety by sending his letter to newspapers, it seems odd that if they were the same person, Bird wouldn't also pronounce himself the Axeman of New Orleans.
That leaves us with the big one, the granddaddy of all Axeman suspects.
Joseph Momfrey?
Joseph Momfrey. The story goes that in 1920, Esther Pepitone herself gunned down a man in an alley, vengeance for the axe murder of her husband in New Orleans. Momfrey had been in and out of jail his entire life, and notably was in jail between 1911 and 1918. And again, during 1918 and 1919, when there was a lull in the Axeman murders. Then he moved out of New Orleans in October 1919, the same time the Axeman disappeared. And in Los Angeles in 1920, he crossed paths with Esther Pepitone, Mike Pepitone's widow, who shot Momfrey dead.
However, there is no written record of any of this actually happening. No death record for anyone in California named Joseph Momfrey between 1905 and 2001. No record of anyone named Esther Pepitone being arrested, charged, or convicted for murder. And though New Orleans police records do show a man named Momfrey, that name and variants of it were common. Like many elements in the Axeman case, it's probably a fabrication.
But you said yourself newspaper reporting from that era was at times unreliable.
Yeah.
So consider this. One of the major players in the New Orleans Italian Mafia War that happened in 1910 and 1911 was a man named Frank Momfrey, who sometimes went by Leon Joseph Momfrey. This Momfrey had previously been arrested for kidnappings and later was convicted for dynamiting a grocery store. The 1910 and 1911 grocer killings that we spoke about last episode happened while Momfrey was awaiting sentencing. He was released in 1915, and shortly after, a Joseph Momfrey popped up as a person of interest in the murder of Vincenzo Moresi, the mafia boss at the center of the war. Then, Momfrey relocated to Los Angeles in 1919 and opened a drugstore in San Bernardino with a friend and associate, Angelo Albano. But after a business disagreement, Albano disappeared, and when Momfrey showed up at the Albano home to shake down Albano's wife for money, she shot him, killing him instantly. This wife's name? Esther Albano. And Esther Albano had previously been Esther Pepitone, widow of Mike Pepitone.
That is convoluted.
But plausible. In the time Frank Momfrey or Leon Joseph Momfrey was out of prison, he committed several violent crimes during the period that our Axeman may have been active.
I suppose it's also plausible that if he had been involved in violent crimes from the start of his career as a criminal, and that if all the other characteristics we've covered were accurate, the schizophrenia, the narcissism, the violent outbursts, all that, if those went untreated while he was in prison, then they could have worsened over time, and maybe he moved beyond mafia killings into the Axeman murders.
So, case closed then?
I don't know. It is a nice, albeit tangled, conclusion to the case of the Axeman of New Orleans, and in a way, that's what we want. It's nice to know that, in the end, the bad guys get caught and the rest of us can go on living our lives. It's certainly better than the alternative.
What's that?
Remember what John D'Antonio, the retired New Orleans police detective, said about the Axeman?
The murderer is likely a Jekyll and Hyde personality, like Jack the Ripper. A criminal of dual personality type may be a respectable, law-abiding citizen when his normal self. Then suddenly, the impulse to kill comes upon him, and he must obey it.
That covers a lot of serial killers. Ted Bundy was described by many as handsome, intelligent, and charming. Dennis Rader, the BTK killer, was the president of his church council and was a Cub Scout leader. John Wayne Gacy worked as a clown at fundraisers and children's parties. What scares us about the Axeman is that a monster could be sitting in the car next to you, or in the cubicle across the hall, or even in your own home. Someone you know or love could be waiting to do the absolute worst to you and your family. And it could be your best friend, your sister, or the host of your favorite podcast.
Well, that's about all we have on the X-Man. And thank you for listening to Serial Killers. Be sure to join us next Monday when we look into the mind of Donald Henry Gaskins. If you enjoyed this episode, please tell your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Serial Killers on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, or any other podcast directory. Or through our website, parcast.com. That's parcast.com. A new episode of Serial Killers comes out every Monday. Please let us know what you think and join the conversation on our Parcast Facebook page. You can tweet us at Parcast Network. That's P-A-R-C-A-S-T Network. Have a killer week. Serial Killers was created by Max Cutler and developed by Ron Cutler. It's a production of Cutler Media and is part of the Parcast Network. It's produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Ron Shapiro, with production assistance by Joel Stein and Maggie Admire. Serial Killers is written by Zach Cannon and stars Greg Polson and Vanessa Richardson. The amazing cast of voice actors includes, by alphabetical order, Mike Capozzi, Janice Liebhart, Harris Markson, Nicholas Massu, and Steve Pinto.